Greenville, South Carolina. And I went to school in Ohio. It was at Hamilton, Ohio. Washington, Illinois. Maybe I skipped one or two. But I spoke to the school in Honolulu. I spoke to the school in Korea. And they didn't have a school in operation in Japan when I was over there, but I went to where they were going to organize one. It's been a joy of my life, if I've been able to do anything, to make such a contribution. Next to the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress, church history has been my hobby. And I've been buying books for the last few years. In my will, Ms. Glover and my daughter, if they survive me, are to have the privilege of choosing for my library the books they want. The remainder of my library will go to the library in the seminary in Little Rock. And I'm buying books that probably I won't use much, I'll read them. But I'm buying them with the idea, when they can be found, some of them are rare, that they may go on the shelves in the library in Little Rock, in order that young people who come after me may have the advantage and the opportunity to study history in the books that I'm to leave in the library. And I'll be glad, when I'm gone, for these books to go in the library in Little Rock, where they'll remain until they're wore out. I thank you very graciously.
The song that I'm going to sing tonight is
a story. There was a man from the extension service at the university was delivering an address to a group of farmers. Well, his address was just statistics. He'd talk a while, drink some water, and talk some more, and drink some water, and the fellows all got tired of it. Finally, one of them punched the other one. He said, "Jim, that's the first windmill I ever saw run by water." So, I've always been accused of being the windmill, and you've got the water here, so get ready. I have enjoyed being here. I wasn't normal when I left home. The doctor said he thought I'd be able to come. I asked Ms. Glover and my daughter if they thought I was able to come. Ms. Glover said, "If you're able to make it at all, go." That woman has helped me for 55 years. And she's always said, "Go if you can." I've been a lot of places. I've been with a lot of people. I've never been more hospitably received or better treated, nor had better fellowship, nor an enjoyable occasion anywhere anymore than I've had here. Thank you for the invitation and the privilege of coming, spending these days with you. I hope more water. I hope I've been able to make a contribution that'll help. And tonight I've come to the cream of all of it.
I sat down since I got to the church house and made my notes for my lecture this evening. I didn't make them until I got here because I was afraid to forget them if I did. So, from what I have on this little piece of paper, I'll try to speak to you. By my watch, it's exactly 8 o'clock. And I don't know what time it'll be when I quit. But I have enough material right here on this piece of paper to talk to you till midnight. And I'm going to just try to rehearse and review some of the history that I deem the most important, the most satisfying and gratifying of any church history that I've ever read. I'm going to start out with Baptists in Pennsylvania. When William Penn settled Pennsylvania, he was a Quaker. He welcomed into his realm the Quaker religion. And he was tolerant of other religions. In Virginia, as I mentioned this morning, and I'll get on to that later, Baptists were persecuted. They were persecuted in all of New England, New York, except Rhode Island. This word went back to Europe, to the England, Wales. And people who were being persecuted in that area, planning to come to the colonies, learned that they would not be persecuted in the state of Pennsylvania. In 1686, a Baptist preacher in Wales named Henry Gregory decided he had come to America. Quite a number of the congregation, of which he was pastor, decided they had come with him. They came to Pennsylvania and settled on Pennypeck Creek, just out of Philadelphia. It's in the Philadelphia territory now. It's incorporated in Philadelphia. There they secured a tract of land and named it Welsh Tract. They were all from Wales. In 1687, Elias Keach, son of the famous Keach, who was pastor of the First Baptist Church in London, came to Pennsylvania and was associated with Henry Gregory. And in the year 1687, they organized the First Baptist Church in Pennsylvania. And they named it Welsh Tract. Along at the same time, a preacher named Killingsworth had organized a church in Delaware that was called Cohansey. He organized another church and named it Piscataquag. Then there came from Wales an ordained Baptist preacher with an ordained church, Thomas Griffith. Thomas Griffith decided he'd come to America. A number of the congregation decided they had come with him, and it was suggested that it might be well for them to organize a church before they left Wales. So they came to this country as an organized church. I erred when I said they named that church Welch Tract. They named it Lower Dublin under Gregory and Teach. And the church that was organized in England and came with the pastor Thomas Griffith came to Gregory and was there a little while. They moved on down, got a tract of land, and they named their church Welch Tract. I'll come back to that and go to deal with associations. These were the first Baptist churches in Pennsylvania. Now I want to talk about the Baptist churches in Virginia. I mentioned that this morning. The separate Baptists in the main organized the churches in Virginia. And I mentioned how they grew from 1760 until 1790. There was 200 churches organized. And the churches in Carolina. The first church in Carolina was at Grassy Creek. Out of that church, others came, and they organized an association that if I don't forget it, I'll deal with a little later. The Baptists in Kentucky. Along around 1780, Daniel Boone, you know, was an explorer, and a man named Harrod went over the Allegheny Mountains into the Kentucky Territory, decided to move over there and build communities. They each built a strong fort to protect the people against the Indians. One of them was called Boonesboro, and the other Harrodsboro. First Baptist preacher that ever went over the Allegheny Mountains and entered the territory of Kentucky was Squire Boone, a brother to Daniel Boone. Wasn't very long after that until others from Pennsylvania and from Virginia went over the mountains and they began to organize churches. And in Kentucky, churches, both of the regular Baptists and the separate Baptists, were organized. The Baptists in South Carolina, out of the Welch Tract Church, quite a number of the people decided they'd move south into South Carolina. They moved out of the Welch Tract Church down into South Carolina and organized a church and called it Welch Neck. So if you take that line, the Baptists in Pennsylvania and these from Pennsylvania went on into Kentucky, and out of the church in Pennsylvania called Welch Tract, the church was organized and many churches came out of that in South Carolina. So the Baptist in South Carolina was through the church in Pennsylvania, which was out of Wales. And it's a very beautiful link-up. And then we had the Baptist in Missouri. Baptist in Missouri begun in about the year 1805. The first church was organized in 1806. And the second was organized in 1807. The first one was called Tiwapiti. And that was the first Baptist church west of the Mississippi River. And that was at about where Cape Girardeau, Missouri is now. And other churches were organized and associations constituted there in 1816. So, a little later on, I'll get to the Baptist in Arkansas. Now I want to talk about associations. The churches in Rhode Island was organized by Clark and probably later on, I think Providence was scripturally organized, the first in the country. Wasn't any association organized in that area until 1767. It was organized in Warren, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and they named it the Warren Association. Now, that was not the first association. The first Baptist association in America was the Philadelphia Association. It is organized by five churches. These five churches were the ones that I've already mentioned. Lower Dublin, Welsh Tract, Middletown, Cohansey, Piscataqua. These five churches constituted the Philadelphia Association in the year 1707. They kept a record of their work for the next 100 years and published it in a book that's called the Philadelphia Association, the minutes of it. That's been republished. You can get a hold of a copy of it now. It's been republished, but I have one of the original copies that I suppose I've had for 50 years. It's very interesting to study. Some of the greatest preachers that's ever been in America belong to that association. They grew and developed, and they adopted a constitution and a declaration of principles, and the Philadelphia Confession was fashioned after the first confession of faith by the people in England. Finally, the thing was revised and comes out of what's called the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. Many, many churches grew out of that associational effort. The first Baptist college in America was started in Pennsylvania by the Philadelphia Association. Philadelphia Association embraced the churches all over, even including those in Rhode Island. And they moved the school from Pennsylvania to Providence, Rhode Island. There they called it the Brown College. And the university there now is the outgrowth of the first Baptist school in the United States. First time I was in Providence, went into the church house, and they had just recently, a few days before, held their graduating exercises there, and there was a lot of the literature on the seats, and I gathered up some of it and took it home. And I got good history out of that. When the churches out of the Philadelphia Association were organized, first churches in Virginia, a number of the churches had been constituted, and they were a long ways from where the association met, the Philadelphia Association. And in the year 1766, six churches petitioned the Philadelphia Association for the privilege of constituting an association in Virginia. This was granted, and in that year, in 65, they petitioned, they organized the association in 1766. They called it the Catoctin Association. Well, out of the Catoctin Association and the Philadelphia Association, I have a list, but I haven't got the names of them here, but some 20 associations were organized from the Carolinas east of the Allegheny Mountains, up to the Warren Association in Rhode Island. There never has been such a growth of Baptist influence in churches as was in that period of time. When the churches were organized in Kentucky, several of them, and there were more regular, separate Baptists than were regular Baptists. First association organized in Kentucky was the Elkhorn Association in 1785. Well, communication and transportation between different points was obscure. The same year, the separate Baptists also organized the regular Baptist organized association. I'll get to the separate in a minute. The Salem Association was organized. And so the separate Baptists were in South Kentucky. They organized an association called the Southern Kentucky Association. All right. The separate Baptists, as I told you in an earlier address, that were divided from the regulars by the influence of George Whitefield, were separated from early, a good many 50, 60 years. The first time any of these two groups came together was in 1785 in North Carolina. What kept them apart so long was the Calvinism of the regular Baptists. And, believe it or not, the Philadelphia Association was organized of that group, and the separate Baptists in their work wouldn't affiliate with them because of that thing. Finally, they met together and agreed among themselves that we be brethren. While they may not agree on one particular point of doctrine, that wasn't sufficient to keep them separated in fellowship. So the first United Baptists were in North Carolina in 1785. Other associations began to consider that, and in 1815, the Baptists in Kentucky united by the Elkhorn Association, the Southern Baptist Association, in communication. Finally, each one of these groups sent a committee. They formulated a plan by which they might unite. They met and organized in Tate's Creek Church, what's called the Tate's Creek Association. That was organized in 1793. And out of that association came the Tate's Creek Association in Kentucky around Somerset, Cumberland River Association. And out of that came other associations. So our people have been divided. They've sought to have fellowship and come together and have fellowship together. They've worked together. Some of the greatest preachers ever lived in that era. Men like John Gaino. John Gaino traveled all the way from New York, Florida, and Georgia. He organized the First Baptist Church in New York City. He was a chaplain in Washington's army. And I've read in books, and I had Brother Bogard's book. I don't know whether it can be definitely proved or not. George Washington is said to have been baptized in the Hudson River by John Gano, who was one of his chaplains in the army. Now I want to come back a little later to this thought. But now I want to try to deal for a little while with the effort put forth, the manner in which religious liberty was first found and introduced in any commonwealth outside of Rhode Island. I mentioned this morning that Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Patrick Henry as statesmen, John Leland, Elijah Craig, and James Child were the principal leaders in the Baptist ranks. During the 1760s, the Baptists in Virginia organized their association, a commonwealth, a community affair. It started by a meeting of the preachers. And that went on for a few years, and finally they invited into it the messengers of the churches that we would call the laity. One of the main purposes of their organization was to make a fight for religious liberty. And in the year 1774, the association drew up a resolution which they intended to present to the House of Burgesses, which we call our House of Representatives, our Legislative Assembly, and see if they couldn't get passed by the Legislative Assembly a law in Virginia that would grant religious liberty to Baptists and other people. Thomas Jefferson was very familiar with Baptist practices. He had lived close to a Baptist church. Some of these preachers were his intimate friends. This resolution was submitted to Thomas Jefferson for his study and his approval. And then it was submitted to James Madison after, I'd say, Thomas Jefferson edited it. It went into the hands of James Madison. When the Constitution of the United States was drafted, there were 13 colonies, and the instrument itself provided that it would not become effective unless as many as 9 of the colonies ratified it. 7 of the colonies had ratified it, but New York and Virginia hadn't. Well, New York and Virginia were the strongest of the colonies, so far as the number of persons and their strength. They were the strongest. They figured that the Constitution never would be effective unless they could get New York and Virginia to ratify it. James Madison was a member of the House of Burgesses. And after these 7 states had ratified the Constitution, Virginia would be 8, New York would be 9. If they could get to 9, then the Constitution would be effective. They held constitutional conventions in all of the states. And John Leland, as I mentioned this morning, was as brilliant as these other fellows. It's a Baptist preacher, and they recognized him as an intellectual giant and a devoted Baptist preacher. And when the time came to elect delegates to the Constitutional Convention in Virginia, James Madison wanted to be a delegate. But he is off up in New England. John Leland offered himself as the candidate for a delegate to the convention. His candidacy hadn't gone very far until Madison returned to Virginia. Well, Madison wanted to be a delegate from that district, and Leland was a candidate. And Madison didn't want to run against Leland. There's a lot of Baptists around there. And they got together in a conversation and talked. And they entered into a compromise. Leland told Madison, "I'll withdraw from the race, and I'll support you on one condition. That one condition is that you introduce this resolution in the Legislative Assembly of Virginia, and then if and when that passes, and the Constitution becomes effective, you'll use your influence to see to it that Amendment Number 1 to the Constitution particularly is added to it." So the delegates adopted the Constitution. James Madison, then, after Jefferson submitted this document back to the assembly, the association, it went then into the hands of James Madison. In the year 1777, he introduced it in the House of Burgesses in Virginia. No action was taken on it. It came up again in the year 1779, and no action was taken on it. But in the year 1785, the Legislative Assembly of Virginia adopted the Baptist Association resolution that vouchsafed religious liberty to the people in Virginia. All right, the Episcopal rectors and bishops in that area had what they call glebes, G-L-E-B-E-S, glebes. What a glebe was, he had a parsonage, and this glebe was a parcel of land. And at the same time, that was cultivated, and it grew, you know, Virginia was a tobacco-growing country, and there's a good price on it. Well, the pastor of the Episcopal Church would get the income from the glebe. And Patrick Henry balked on one piece of legislation that was introduced in Virginia. That was to deprive the Episcopal pastors of their glebes. And all of this time, up till 1785, as a matter of law, the Baptists would not only have to support their own work, but by taxes, they were having to support those who were persecuting them. And under, they got that piece of legislation passed that vouchsafed that no one, contrary to his own religion, would of necessity by any force be compelled to support any other of the religious denominations, particularly the Episcopals. Well, all Patrick Henry knew about the support of churches was that it was done by taxation. Madison introduced that legislation, and Patrick Henry opposed it. And he opposed it. He was a friend of the Baptists, and he thought he was doing them a favor. But he pulled that legislature on the basis of his opinion that the churches could not exist without government support. He didn't want that relief of the taxation removed from that piece of legislation. Religious liberty was not granted to the folks in Massachusetts, even though the Constitution was adopted in 1787. But religious liberty didn't come to the Baptists in Massachusetts until 1835. All right, when the Constitution was adopted and Virginia had passed the first piece of legislation to make religion free in Virginia, outside of the charter in Rhode Island, was the first piece of legislation enacted by a local government in a given area in the history of all of the world that vouchsafed Baptist liberty to Baptists and to other denominations. So when the time came, Madison was elected to Congress. Leland stayed on him. And Isaac Backus stayed on him. And when the time came for the adoption of the Constitution, there's a little bit of an error in my message. I think that Madison was a member of the House of Burgesses, but he was a member of Congress when the Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia. Leland stayed on him. That according to his agreement and his promise, he was used his influence in that Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia to have religious liberty set up in it. First thing they passed didn't suit the Baptists. They appealed to Washington. About all they did first was to fix it so that any religion would not bar a man from political office. Baptists had never been allowed to run for office. But under that, they were allowed to. And they weren't satisfied with that. They went to Washington to have that strengthened. So, Madison and Leland were on Backus, I said Madison, Isaac Backus of New England. Five men are more responsible for religious liberty in America than all of the rest of them put together. John Leland and Isaac Backus, Baptist preachers. Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, and James Madison. So they managed to pass in the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, the amendments that's called the Bill of Rights. The First Amendment provides that they should never enact any legislation that would affect the freedom of worship and so on. In the brief detail, that's the story of how religious liberty would come to this country. And after it was in the National Constitution, naturally, persecution ceased. Now back to my story about the Baptists and spreading out. These United Baptists in Kentucky began to scatter. And about 1820, some of them moved into Arkansas in what is now Saline County. And in 1822, they organized a church in Saline County, and they named it Kentucky Baptist Church. That church was organized out of United Baptists out of Kentucky. And they called it the Kentucky United Baptist Church. I'll leave that there for a minute. I'll follow another line. From the Baptists in Missouri, when the Bethel Association was organized in 1816, they began to send out missionaries. And not far from Cape Girardeau, where these churches were, to the northern boundary of Arkansas, and they sent missionaries into Arkansas. First Baptist Church in my state was organized in 1818. Near the present town of Pocahontas, they called it Antioch. Well, that church lived for a number of years, and other churches grew out of that. Eventually, the Spring River Association was organized as the first in Arkansas. Later on, Biometer was organized, and that's now the oldest active association in the United States, and it has been organized sometime about along in the 1840s, or 1825. So, out of the church that was organized at Kentucky in 1822, other churches were organized. And in 1836, Spring Creek Church at Benton was organized. And the man who helped organize the church up at, called Antioch, was J.Y. Lindsay. He wasn't a preacher. He came down to Saline County and helped organize Kentucky Church. By that church was ordained to preach, became one of the greatest preachers that ever lived in our area. And out of the churches in that area, they organized the Saline Association in the year 1836 in Spring Creek Church, the same year that the association was organized. My mother's people had moved there a little bit later and belonged to that church. Out of that Missouri group came the churches in North Arkansas. Out of Kentucky Church, out of Kentucky, the members who came from Kentucky settled in Central Arkansas. Carry that on to the conclusion. In 1854, the association in Arkansas that joins us on the south was the Judson Association. It was organized of churches out of the Saline Association. In 1861, the Pine Bluff Association, in which I live, was organized out of the Judson Association. Long about the same time, out of the Saline Association down in South Arkansas was the Union Association. The Union Association persisted to the split in our work in 1950, and the Union Association split. So the migration of Baptists followed the frontier of civilization. As civilization would advance, Baptists would advance with it. North, or south, and west. And all of our churches west of the Mississippi River came out of the influence of the mission endeavors of the churches and associations on the east side of the river. I haven't had time to examine these books that was presented to me. I had one in my hand. And I glanced through it to try to gain a little bit of information. What happened to the Baptists migrating into Arkansas happened in all of the other areas. When this territory was settled, I remember the yow that we had with England over the division according to a parallel up here. I studied that. But along around the 1840s, about 1850, the first pioneer Baptist preachers came into Oregon. And I'm glad to see the history there that names a lot of the preachers and a lot of the deacons, shows their pictures and their wives. And your work grew and flourished here for a good long while. Things happened. Now for a little bit, and I don't think I'll talk but about 5 or 10 minutes longer, we'll talk about the convention and its influence. The first idea of a convention system was organized in England. In 1792, a bunch of laymen who were mission-minded met in Fuller's office. there they laid the plans for a fellowship together to promote missions. Not supported or authorized by a church. Now, I'll give you my idea about the convention. In my mind, the convention is unscriptural. I wouldn't brand unscriptural some churches in the convention. I'm talking about the convention itself. But they were successful in sending missionaries to Burma and elsewhere. That idea never came up in America until 1814. And out of the movement was begun there, what they call the Triennial Convention was organized. They sent out some missionaries. The missionaries that sent out by that got over in Burma. They met some English missionaries. And they decided, according to what they learned by association, that they hadn't been scripturally baptized. So they joined up with the British. And when they left the Triennial Convention support, the faucet was shut off. So one of them came back to this country to try to arrange the thing so that their support might be continued. That had a lot of influence on the churches for quite a while. The Southern Baptist Convention was constituted in the year 1845. In December of that year, by an act of the legislature of the state of Georgia, the Southern Baptist Convention was incorporated. Its preamble and constitution adopted and signed by the governor and secretary of state. So the Southern Baptist Convention was not made up of churches. It is made up of individuals. There were delegates there from churches. There were delegates there from the several different groups among the Baptists. But when the convention was organized, it was not organized under church authority. It became a corporation. I don't know of anything in God's Word that would indicate that it's scriptural to assume authority, and where a church can redelegate authority, and as such, my judgment is that the convention system as such, is unscriptural. They took the matter of missions and a lot of other things largely away from the churches. The mission committee and the executive committee has a lot to do with it. I have a number of minutes of the Southern Baptist Convention, and in the minute of 1952, the Constitution's published in it, and Article 4 says, that we are an independent sovereign. And our purpose is not to try to lord it over the churches. An independent sovereign. Separate and apart from the churches. There's no such thing in the Bible. No such thing. Well, the Arkansas State Convention was organized in 1848. And at that time, they weren't any more convention than we are now. Not a bit. And about all of the churches in our area were incorporated in the state convention. From 1848 until early 1900. The division between our people and the convention started around 1900. The Baptist Missionary Association of Texas was organized about 1850. And the division and our association is 61. And we were, not the Baptist Association, the Texas folks were in the convention like Arkansas. The BMA of Texas was organized about 1900. The Arkansas Baptist State Convention, or the General Assembly, the General Association of Baptists in Arkansas, changed its name to the State Association, was in 1902. I have the minutes of the Pine Bluff Association, which I live, of that period. And it might be interesting to know, and with this I think I'm through, what caused the separation in my state, and that was what happened all over, was over the mission question. In 1900, Brother Bogard held a meeting at Sheridan. And I've known Bogard all his life until he died from 1900. My older sister was converted under his preaching at that time. She was 10 years old. He attended the Pine Bluff Association in 1901 and preached there. In 1901, NIA local association, dissatisfaction with the practices of the state convention was discussed in the Pine Bluff Association. Action was taken by a committee, no official action. Same thing in 1902. By that time, the state convention had hired a secretary to pay him a wage, and they balked on that. Believe it or not, that's why we separated. Well, we're paying the secretary, aren't we? We were all together, had the same doctrine, the same practices. But when they begin to use money that they thought ought to go to a missionary to pay a fellow to keep a record, they couldn't take that. So they separated. During all these years, from 1902 in Arkansas, there had not been much fellowship between the convention and us. I understand you all have just about closed the gap. And time's coming and we're going to have to close. Because of liberalism, alien immersion, and open communion, those things we cannot tolerate. So when we stand here and look back to those who brought the gospel to Oregon and those who carried it to them, we look back through the centuries. The Baptists, the Anabaptists, and all of the other names that our people have been called, clear back to the day when the Lord said, I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Thank God, the gates of hell have not prevailed against it, and one day He's coming to this world, sound of trumpets, call His church to it. And then arrangements are going to be made for the pattern of all weddings when the marriage of the Lamb takes place to His bride, the church. God bless you and thank you. I wonder if anybody here don't belong to a church like that. If you don't, how do you feel about it? If you belong to something else, I'm not critical of you. I did once. I found no satisfaction in it. I drew out of it. I found satisfaction with the people with whom I'm affiliated now. I'm glad I don't belong to a church that I can read where a certain man at a certain time organized a church 1,400 years, 1,700 years, 1,900 years, this side of the time when the Lord organized His. I want to go back to the one the Lord organized, and I think I found it. And God bless you, brethren. I think you have found it too, and that you're in it. while we sing a verse or two of a song, with the pastor standing here, is anybody here that's dissatisfied with your present state? You're unsaved. Trust the Lord, He'll save you. If you've been saved and not baptized, you're not happy, and I know it. I tried that. Do your duty. And if you're a member of a church out yonder somewhere and you live here, keep covenant. Whatever the Lord leads you to do tonight, will you do it? For my sake? No. For the Lord's sake and for your good conscience. Will you do it while we stand in the presence of Satan? Hold it, hold it, hold it.
Very courteous attention. We have really worked Brother Hubbard this week, Brother Glover this week. He told me I had one more day to call him by his right name, and that was 3 days ago. We're going to have one more message from him tomorrow. It's a little late, but I want to make mention of this. Brother Gordon Harris was baptized in the New Pine Creek Church. Is that right? And in studying about the churches there in the Goose Lake Valley area, I was reading some time back about one of the charter members came from the Riverside Church in New York City, which was organized in those early days of the Philadelphia Association. And you heard quite a bit said about the Philadelphia Association tonight and those churches that were organized. The Bend Church here was organized in 1938. That doesn't go back very far. But we had members from the Cloverdale Church, the Fossil Church, no, not the Fossil Church, the Mitchell Church, the Gateway Church, and the Lone Pine Church, I believe it was. And most of these churches went back in the 1800s and were organized out of these other churches. And we have a definite connection to these very churches that Brother Glover spoke of. It's very interesting to me, too, in the late 1700s, in Daniel Boone's day, the Purdue's left Virginia and came to the Somerset, Kentucky area. The Gap Creek Church, where my people lived, was organized in 1804, a United Baptist Church. Most of my people were bootleggers, but through the work of that church, many of them were saved and became active in the Baptist work. And so history to me is an exciting thing. But the most beautiful thing about church history, Jesus said, "Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against her." And I believe that. "Unto him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus throughout all ages, world without end." We have some very definite historical landmarks that we can follow back to the days of Christ. But as Brother Glover brought out, most of our records have been destroyed by those who likewise destroyed our people. But by faith, we know that we have a succession of churches back to the days of Christ. Thank the Lord for that. We may not appreciate it much now, but the more we learn about it, the more we appreciate it. And the more church history, Baptist history, becomes precious to us. Is there a word from anyone before?
Brother.
Brother.
I knew some of your early brethren. I knew most of the older Playlock brethren. I knew J.G. Moore, who were very active in establishing our kind of work in your great state.
Amen.
I heard one of the Blaylock brothers preach. I was associated closely with Brother Moore for 3 or 4 years, and I had met the other Blaylock, who were missionaries in China and then came back to this country. So I know a little something about the type of men pioneered in your work. Thank you.
Amen. Brother Harrison.
This may be